This is Rob Pincus, and welcome to the Rob Pincus Podcast.
The Rob Pincus Podcast is brought to you by the Personal Defense Network. The Personal Defense Network is the leading destination of high-quality online personal defense video content and a no-nonsense gathering place for those serious about arming themselves for defense in every aspect of their lives. To learn more, visit www.personaldefensenetwork.com. Now, here's Rob.
On today's show, we're going to do something a little different, and I'm excited about it because this show is going to be much more of a real conversation, a real dialogue. You know, obviously, the hope is that while I speak into this microphone, you're receiving information, you're finding it valuable. And of course, some of the early feedback that we've gotten here in just a few episodes of the Rob Pincus Podcast has definitely indicated that people are finding value in it, and the numbers indicate that. So I hope you're subscribed. I hope you're sharing it. Today, you're going to get a treat. We're going to go into our first real dialogue on this podcast, and it's going to be with the guy who really is responsible for the podcast even existing. Jeff Ott reached out to me in late 2021 and said, Rob, you know, you've got a message, you've got information, you obviously love sharing it, and there's people out there that want to hear it, and that he thought maybe even more people needed to hear it. And he said, I do podcasts, you should do a podcast, I'll produce it for you, let's make this happen. And I thought, you know what, man, cool. If you think the information is important enough and you've got the know-how and the talent to help me deliver it through this medium, through a podcast, that's going to be great. You know, this was something I tried to do on my own, believe it or not, as far back as 2006, 2007, during the Valhalla Training Center. I produced 8 or 9 episodes of a podcast, a would-be Valhalla Training Center podcast, and it just really didn't take off. And honestly, I didn't have the technical know-how, the engineering, and the discipline to make sure that it happened on a regular basis. So that just kind of faded away. So here we are, you know, well over a decade later with Jeff Ott as the engineer, the producer, the man making everything happen in the background. And today he's going to come into the foreground. And that's exciting because he's going to represent not only questions he has as a student of self-defense and armed defense, but also some of the things that he thinks you'd be interested in hearing, the perspective that he's seeing with a direct lead to the feedback we've gotten on the early episodes. And certainly a lot of the feedback that I've gotten on the information that I've put out and the Personal Defense Network has put out over the years. So that's coming up for the first time today, and I'm really looking forward to the feedback on that. But first, let's talk about Personal Defense Network. When this podcast is over, you need to head over to personaldefensenetwork.com and check out what I believe is the best collection of free information regarding armed defense, training, all sorts of ways that you can become better prepared to defend yourself or those that you care about. We've got emergency medical information, information on training concepts and theory. Of course, we've got a lot of information on the gear that you might be interested in, the guns, the holsters, the optics, the medical equipment, all of that stuff available at personaldefensenetwork.com. And thousands of pieces of content are there. Many of them, most of them, in fact, and just over half are free. Of course, you can get into higher levels of membership. You can register for the free newsletter. You can become a premium member. You can become a gold level member. And of course, you can take advantage of distance education there too. We have complete online classes. And it's not just me. So if you get enough of me out of this podcast, that's cool. You can learn from some of the greatest experts in the field. This information has been collected for over 15 years. And I'm sure you'll recognize some of the names over there. Maybe discover a few new gurus or resources for you to add to your collection at personaldefensenetwork.com. With that said, let's get into a discussion on training. You know, the first segment of the Rob Pincus Podcast is always on training and training concepts. And I know that this guy, again, he thinks this message is important and he has specific pieces of information he wants me to talk about today. Jeff Ott, welcome to the front side of the Rob Pincus Podcast.
Well, thanks a lot, Rob. And I appreciate the opportunity to be on this side of the microphone and participate with you maybe be the voice for some of the listeners out there and provide some of those questions that some people may be afraid to ask. I'm used to asking the stupid questions, what may sound like stupid questions. So thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. You know, that a lot of instructors will say, you know, there's no such thing as a stupid question. There are, but I want to hear them anyway. You know, it's kind of important because it's this dumb question. The way I do that, I always like, look, if you've been in a class for 4 hours and I said something 5 times and you're just getting around to noticing it, or you haven't noticed it yet and you're still asking the question, you know, okay, I wish you would have paid attention. But at some point, you know, that is my fault as the instructor. So I blame me for the stupid questions usually in class. We'll see what happens today. Let's go for it.
Well, good. You know, I'm just a little bit about, I appreciate that, a little bit about my background. I do have grew up in a family of hunters and everything, but from a defensive shooting and pistols, got into that with some friends who was very interested in competition, defensive shooting, and that was my introduction into shooting and this type of style and format. And then several years ago, when you passed through the Pacific Northwest, taking some of your training, and so I went from competing all the time in local and state matches to being more of a student of the defensive use of the pistol. And it is a different mindset. And that was really kind of enlightening to me. And I do appreciate what I have learned.
Yeah. That's probably one of the biggest, you know, light bulb moments. Yeah. It's one of those blue pill, red pill things that some people, you know, I mean, people will argue about it on the internet forever, but you know, you may have seen some of the stuff that I did with Rob Latham. You know, he is, you know, undoubtedly the most decorated and probably still one of the greatest handgun competitors in the history of handgun competition, yeah. Literally like on earth. And he's been winning world and national championships for the last 30 years. And, you know, for him and I to be able to convey information to people and, you know, I think of videos we did like Toss the Timer, and some of the other ones where he made it really clear, like, yeah, you know, take it from the guy who really does the competition pretty darn well. Mm-hmm. It's different when you go to train for defensive shooting, and far too many defensive shooting classes still look like, you know, a lot of timers, a lot of choreography and a lot of people trying to score points. And that's unfortunate, but welcome to the other side of that. And I'm glad I was able to open that door.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. On that theme, and let's go back to a couple episodes ago, you're talking about training and timing and how they are, some of the competitions are choreographed. And this is not a slam against competitions. There's a lot to be gained in competition, both from just getting used to handling a weapon to being the camaraderie of the other shooters, and a good way to spend a Saturday or Sunday. But when you start looking at it from a defensive point of view and you look at the beginning of a stage and where you step through each stage, you're told how many rounds of ammunition you start with. They show you how a target moves, and how long it takes before it shows up, how long it's there and disappears. And you realize, you know, what is this preparing me for? Is it, you know, what are my goals? And that was a light bulb moment for me. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's an important moment. It really is. And you know, I want to touch on something. You mentioned the camaraderie and a great way to spend a Saturday. Like, I'm not anti-competition, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I run the gun makers matches now. You know, I've done everything: cowboy action shooting, IDPA, you know, all kinds of action shooting stuff. This year, I'm getting into some precision rifle stuff. Been working with Nemo. We'll be talking more about that as we move forward, and maybe even some extreme long range competitions are in my near future. We'll be talking about on the podcast. But that doesn't mean that I think about competition being more important than my defensive training. And when it just simply isn't. Mm-hmm. And for those who are serious students of defense and those who are carrying a gun with the intention of defending themselves or others or staging a gun in their home to defend their families, I think that they need to be able to make that distinction and then also make the educated choice about how much time, effort, and energy they're going to put into the competition side. So it is a great way to spend a Saturday or it's a fun way. It's fun to go to the range and see yourself getting better incrementally at certain drills, you know, certain standards drills, if you will, that we know are going to be core parts of different competitions, a trap, skeet, sporting plays. It's fun to go out with friends. It's fun to see your score improve, but that's not really what drives me as a gun owner. And I don't think it's what drives the majority of gun owners. It's not what should be driving them, especially when they say, and overwhelmingly in every poll and every survey and everything the National Shooting Sports Foundation does and everything I hear about anecdotally from people that own gun shops, people own guns for defense. So let's stay focused on that when it comes to the training and skill development.
Rob, one of the things you mentioned in the earlier episode is the startle reflex or the flinch reflex. And I think that's, if I think back to that first class, that was one of the things that most people had the most difficult time to learn to deal with and how to reenact it, how to incorporate that into their training. Can you go a little bit more in depth on what that looks like and how a person at the range by themselves and or with a buddy can practice that?
Yeah, it's sort of a high level pretending. Right. And when we talk about visualization, we talk about imagining that you're assessing the environment. We talk about why you're in a lowered center of gravity athletic position. You're in a very tense athletic position when you take a gun to the ready position. You know, why you wouldn't just be standing there relaxed right? You'd never be in the public space with a gun out of your holster held in the high compressed ready if there wasn't something tensing you up, right? You wouldn't be very relaxed just casually strolling through the park that way. So, or the mall, much less, you know, in any of those spaces. So why are we able to put ourselves in a lowered center of gravity? Well, it's because we're pretending. It's because everybody accepts that reality. So what we're really trying to do with that first level of introduction to integrating your body's natural reactions is just simply get people to accept that it's very, very likely that if their gun is in their holster and they're in the public space, that if they have to use their gun immediately, it's going to immediately follow having been startled, having been ambushed. You know, we talk about that counter-ambush training methodology in an earlier episode as well. And this idea of integrating the startle reaction is no different than covering your gun up before you reach for it and draw it when you're practicing your defensive shooting drills, right? If you think it makes sense to wear your concealment garment and sweep it out of the way as you grab your gun, because that's the realistic context for presenting a gun from a holster in a defensive situation, well, then it should eventually, right, just make just as much sense that you should lower your center of gravity, focus on the source of the ambush, and move your hands protectively prior to reaching for the gun to sweep the concealment garment, to put your hand on the grip, and go through all those steps. And that is a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people. But it is conceptually exactly the same. I think that's the incredibly important part that people, that's really where the moment comes, I think, especially for instructors, when it becomes time for them to educate others and convince them to take this sort of jump as well. It's not a leap of faith. You know, it's exactly the same logic that leads you to wear a concealment garment. It's exactly the same logic that leads you to imagine that you're looking for another threat. It's exactly the same logic that leads you to fire an unknown number of rounds because you accept that you can't predict how many rounds it will take to stop the next threat. Well, similarly, you can predict that the worst case scenario, and that's really what we're training for, right? We're not training for the easy day when we have to use our gun. The worst case scenario is going to be immediately following an ambush. And we know what it looks like when people get startled. They lower their center of gravity. They turn their attention towards the source of that stimulus, the loud noise, the motion, whatever it was, and they move their hands protectively. And it doesn't have to take a long time. It's not hard physically, but it is sort of mentally hard because it just feels strange. It looks strange. And it's so counterculture to a lot of what people see, you know, on the internet and YouTube and everything else. But acknowledge difficulty. And probably, you know, a lot of people have told me, Rob, I love your program. Program's great. But that startle reaction thing, that just looks silly. You fight about it on the internet. A lot of people make fun of it. Like if you would just let that go, you'd probably be one of the most, you know, universally accepted and popular instructors in the community. And I don't know if that's true, but it's been said a lot. And the fact is, I don't care. It's so important, right, that it's worth fighting that fight and it's worth getting people to understand and accept it. And if somebody says, you know what, I'm going to leave this class and never do it again, but they've been exposed to the idea and they take everything else from the program, that's fine. But I can't put my head on the pillow, you know, or look at my instructor team and take myself seriously if I'm not really pushing the best information that I think we have available. And that includes integrating the startle reaction for counter-ambush training.
Thanks. And I know our time is short for this part of the program, but one of the questions I wanted to ask is in terms of equipment, holster selection and or position on the body for a defensive weapon. Appendix, is it side? Is it inside the waistband, outside?
I can tell you generally inside the waistband is going to be better for most people because it allows you to carry the gun under a wider variety of circumstances, inside the waistband versus outside the waistband. I can tell you that a shorter grip versus a longer grip is generally, again, going to be a better compromise for people because it allows them to carry the gun more often. So when I think about carrying a gun, it's not about the holster brand or even necessarily about the holster position per se, whether it's like on the side or in front of the hip, centerline carry, appendix carry. What it comes down to is how can someone find a way in their life to wear a gun as often as they want to, right? And that may, for many people, be as often as possible. Well, with a gun with a shorter grip, it's going to be possible more often. Depending on the way you dress and your body type, it may be more often possible for you to comfortably conceal a gun for defensive purposes in front of your hips in that centerline appendix carry position. For other people, based on the way they dress and the way maybe they sit or stand or move during the day and their body type, their body shape, it may be easier for them to conceal inside the waistband behind the hip, you know, at the 4 o'clock or maybe even the 5 o'clock position. I can generally say that ankle carry is a bad idea. Pocket carry is a bad idea. Off body carry is a bad idea if you can keep the gun on your body. But it's very, very hard to say, you know, this type of holster for is going to work for 95% of the people. I just haven't found that to be true. Mm-hmm. I can say that about inside the waistband. I can say it about a short gripped gun. One thing I will say, like I use a hybrid holster. I've been using Crossbreed holsters for a long time. Oh, yeah. I was using one of their standard kind of 4 o'clock holsters in the appendix position before they even had an appendix carry holster. And I've used it now for over a decade. I'm a really active guy, right? Like I'm active on the range. I'm active off the range. I do physical things as I move about. I don't worry about, you know, jumping over a fence if I need to, as I'm moving around during the day. I climb stairs. Like I chase around my, you know, 6-year-old. I've been chasing around since she was, you know, obviously able to crawl. Dogs, you know, whatever, athletic stuff. And I'm wearing a gun. Sometimes I did a video clip once where I was wearing my Crossbreed appendix holster, you know, in response to somebody saying they could never hold a gun. And they'll try to, you know, you fall down on the ground, the gun's going to fly out of the holster. Yeah. You know, I was doing backflips on a trampoline a couple of years ago with a gun in that holster without, you know, any extra special preparation, just the same way I wear it every day. It's a very secure holster if it's used and worn properly. So I will throw that flag. Like the reason I use it is because it's so comfortable, right? It allows me to sit in a car for 12 hours, move around, teach all day, whatever I'm doing, and still carry a gun for defensive purposes in a very convenient place. I think the appendix carry offers a lot of advantages to access the gun, especially in extreme close quarters situations. If I were to be, you know, grappling or in contact with someone and not wanting to move my hands away from in front of my body, but still be able to reach the gun, my right hand or my left hand, that's the main reason I choose appendix carry. And it doesn't mean it's for everybody. And it doesn't mean that Crossbreed holsters is the brand for everybody. It doesn't mean hybrid holsters are perfect for everybody, but I do want to make sure that those are given a fair shake and people understand why all carry is a compromise. And comfort is one of those compromises.
And just to follow up on that, what size pistol are you using in that appendix carry? It's not a full size.
Well, you know, what do we call a full size pistol anymore? I mean, when I have a Glock 48 with a 4-inch barrel and 16 rounds ammunition on board, that's pretty close to full size, right? And if you think about, okay, so a Beretta 92 is also 16 rounds of ammunition. The barrel is a little longer, but that gun's probably, you know, twice as wide, and it's also going to be taller and it's going to be longer. And you only get an extra inch of barrel out of it. You know, it's a much more complicated design. That's what I used to think of as a full-size pistol. You know, Beretta Tomcat isn't a full-size pistol, but I feel really comfortable with a Glock 48 with 16 rounds of ammunition.
Real good. Well, thank you.
Yeah, for sure. You know, let's move on to the politics, the gun rights segment of the show, and let's continue with this dialogue. I really do enjoy the back and forth, and I know we've got some great guests lined up to be on the show in the coming months, some episodes. And I think it's exciting that you're the first, you know, quote unquote guest, I guess, on the front side, Jeff. So I'm interested in hearing your thoughts in this area as well, maybe giving out some more information. And this segment is brought to you by Second Amendment Organization. I am the executive vice president of Second Amendment Organization. You can learn more about the organization and what we do and what we advocate for at 2AO.org. You can also check out all of our position statements on about 60 gun rights, gun law issues at gunrights.info. And that's something that's been approved by the entire board. It's not just my opinions, but they are opinions that I hold and defend. You know, Kevin Dixie is another one of our board members. And we've got some of the founders of the organization that have been there since back in the days of Sandy Hook, right up to and including Kevin, who joined us on the board last year. We've all reviewed these position statements. And I think they're a great primer. If you aren't quite sure, you know, you believe in the Second Amendment, but you aren't quite sure what to say when someone asks you about the Firearms Owners Protection Act, or what do we do when we talk about mandatory training? You know, we all know training and education is a good idea, but that word mandatory is kind of sticky. Well, check out gunrights.info, brought to you by 2AO.org. And as always, don't be afraid to donate a little money there at 2AO.org to help the cause, help us keep doing what we're doing in terms of grassroots advocacy. You know, that's really our focus. We want to make sure that people are articulate, intelligent, and passionate, educated advocates in the gun community. But with that said, Jeff, what are your burning thoughts in the areas of politics or gun rights right now?
Everything's so polarized right now. It's hard for me to come up with a justifiable. You know, I don't feel like I can persuade someone more than just provide my rationale why my rights to carry are important. People shouldn't be afraid of that right. And should not be so willing to give it up, and educating them as to why they don't want to just give it up and just say, you know, take all the guns. lock them away.
You know, I think that first part is the most important part of advocacy, being able to represent mm-hmm. your position, right? Not just repeat a catchphrase, not just quote a law or a statistic that you're going to be asked to cite. And there's probably going to be a competing statistic that they can cite. I think it's just simply, here's my story. Here's how I feel. Let's talk about that. Because if you're trying to convince somebody, you know, you talk about persuading somebody, if you're trying to convince them to change their mind, they're going to have to understand, you know, their own articulation. And it's probably not going to come from a statistic. They're probably not going to say, oh, gee, I didn't realize that the Constitution said shall not be infringed. I was totally off base. Let me change my mind on this, right? It's going to be much more personal. It's going to be more emotional. They're going to have to find their way. And I think that is, you know, sort of on your second point, I think that's the mistake that a lot of people make, right? It's educating them about why it's important. You got to remember to add in the first part to you,
right?
Because ultimately they're going to have to decide whether or not it's important to them or not. And honestly, that's not my goal as an advocate. My goal is that they respect the fact that it's important to me, that it's appropriate, that it's justified, that, as you pointed out, it's not a threat to them or their way of life, that I get to responsibly exercise my gun rights. So I think that maybe the emphasis for a lot of people is this burden of persuasion, as opposed to just simply the burden of education and knowing that they're going to have to come to their own conclusion at the end of the day.
And that's good on a one-to-one, but when the one-to-one becomes one-to-many and you're dealing with city councils such as you have there in Denver, or you have state legislatures who may be looking to limit the ability to, I don't even make, you know, the 80% of pistols or rifles. You know, that's the challenge in all of this, right? To say, well, you can have your belief, but don't cut it out for everybody.
Yeah, I think I really do think there is a huge difference between one of the important principles that I always espouse, is that real advocacy happens outside of the gun community, mm-hmm. right? So you have to sort of take away all the fundraising and the cheerleading and the, you know, morale boosting or even self, you know, pity and commiserating sometimes that happens in the gun community, where we have our way of talking about these things and we have our catchphrases and our, you know, Molan Lave and all that stuff. None of those things are going to change any minds outside of the gun community, right? What those things, large organizations will use those kinds of things in social media and email blasts and maybe with an unfair, I think an unhealthy dose of fear mongering quite often to raise funds mm-hmm. and they'll justify it. You know, I end up calling out some of the leaders of these groups privately or maybe even in social media, and I'll get a lot of static. You know, Rob, we got to build the war chest. We got to pay for the lawyers. We got to fight the fight. We got to influence the elections. We got to influence politicians. We got to, you know, support the ones that support us, that kind of a thing. I get it, but that's not what we do at Second Amendment Organization. It's not what I do. But I will say that there is a big difference between the way I will talk to a council member, the way I will talk to a legislator, and the way I will talk to just somebody at the coffee shop or somebody at a dinner party, because there's really two dramatically different things. And while it is absolutely important that every citizen voices their opinion to their elected representatives, that they actively partake in any election opportunity to vote for the representatives that they want to be there in government, wherever they can do it, locally, all the way up to nationally, obviously. But that is a very different thing to just be a gun rights advocate in your everyday, in the stands at your kid's football game, you know, at the PTA meeting, and not speaking to the PTA, but just literally as it's breaking up and somebody says, oh, what are you guys up to this weekend? You say you're going to the range. You're doing gun rights advocacy work in that conversation. And I think in those conversations, that's what I was talking about earlier, where it's just about sharing your perspective, sharing your point of view, sort of de-escalating this perceived threat, making sure that there isn't a characterization that goes against responsible gun owners like yourself, like me, like the people that you know, we hang out with every weekend on the Saturday competitions we were talking about in the first segment, those kinds of things. That's incredibly important. Now, when it comes to time to talk to a legislator or another elected representative, a mayor, whoever it may be, at that point, the conversation does have to be a little different. And it is a little bit trickier. It is a little bit more sophisticated. And there is a bit of obligation, right? There's a bit of, hey, you can have your personal opinion. I don't care if you like guns. I don't care if you want to change the Constitution. And I'll invite people all the time, gun control advocates or anti-gun rights people. Go ahead, go try to change the Constitution. But until you change the Constitution, shall not be infringed is real. So in the halls of government or in the courtrooms across the country, we do tend to cite laws and cite legal precedent and cite Supreme Court cases and talk more about the obligations and civil rights and the responsibilities that elected officials have to uphold the laws and not work against them or undermine them. All of those things become important. But again, at the coffee shop or around the water cooler at work, those aren't the conversations to have, because that person that you're talking to there, they're going to be electing somebody. They're not going to be making the decision themselves. So you want them to be of a mindset where they're not going to support somebody who's running for office who seems to just be anti-gun for the sake of being anti-gun, because guess what? They've been educated that there's a whole bunch of their community members, coworkers, family friends, you know, parents of kids at their schools who are responsible gun owners who don't deserve to have their rights restricted because of some fear mongering that's going on. Yeah. And I think that that's a little bit nuanced, I'm sure, and a little bit challenging maybe to understand the difference, but there is a big difference.
Real good. I appreciate that. And there absolutely is. And I look forward to talking to you further about these subjects as we get further, because it goes pretty deep.
It really does. All right. And with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of the Rob Pincus Podcast. Once again, Jeff, I really appreciate you coming out into the front. Obviously, you know, you have made this whole thing possible. You're making it happen. And I know a lot of people appreciate it. Let me say publicly that I very much appreciate it. But today, especially the idea that you could bring this into the realm of dialogue, that you could bring this to a space where you show me what you're being challenged, what you're curious about. And really, that's what I enjoy about teaching. It's what I enjoy about sharing. It's what I enjoy about lecturing. And that is an element that's missed sometimes on the podcast when I'm doing my monologue. So maybe this was one of the most important segments, I think this last segment that we've done so far. So you, the listener, thank you for being a listener. And please do subscribe and share, especially, you know, today's episode. I think it does a lot of people good in the gun community. Remember that they are the frontline gun rights advocates, and that there is some real simplicity to just sharing their story and demonstrating that they're a responsible gun owner and talking to people in their community and their life and their workplace, their neighborhood about it. You know, one of the things I always say is you basically lost the right if you have to hide your exercise of it, right? So a lot of people in the gun community, I think, are afraid to talk about guns in some places, especially if you live in a more quote unquote liberal area where you don't know who the gun owners are. I promise you, some of the best conversations I've had have started with people kind of looking over their shoulder at the dinner party or at the wine tasting or at the concert, because they know I'm a gun guy, making sure nobody's within earshot, and they tell me they've got guns too. And there's probably four or five people at that party that I end up trying to get together and say, yeah, guess what? We all own guns. Let's get past it. And the one person all of a sudden that doesn't own guns becomes part of the conversation and gets a new understanding about responsible gun ownership. So let's make that happen. Don't forget to visit personaldefensenetwork.com for your own personal education and support Second Amendment organization, 2AO.org. You can learn a lot there too, but we also need your support, and we want our message shared to anybody in the gun community. And as always, be the best responsible gun owner that you can be. Thank you.